From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on all of the news that made headlines this past week, and there's a lot to talk about today. And today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, Nate Sunderland, managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com, and James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
So I want to start with all of the controversy that is surrounding Pride Month in Boise. Jimmy, a lot of this just kind of bubbled to the surface and came to a head just in the last couple of days. And my understanding is that it started when the national organization, the Daily Caller, wrote a story about Boise Pride, and then the Idaho Republican Party responded. So, Jimmy, can you give us a brief overview of what happened and where we are right now?
Yeah, this was a huge firestorm that really ignited on Wednesday with when newly elected Idaho Republican Party Chair Dorothy Moon issuing a press release, Wednesday morning, saying that they called on the sponsors of Boise Pride to pull their sponsorship, grab their money out of there because of a kids' drag event that was scheduled for Sunday, saying that, you know, organizers and supporters are, quote, sexualizing children. The drag event was for those ages 11 through 18. All of them, according to organizers, had their enthusiastic support of their parents. In one case, one child's mother was going to perform on stage with them, is what organizers told me. And now that's been postponed. I mean, it was a quick 24-hour turnaround almost from the first press release to, sponsors pulling out to organizers saying, okay, we're postponing this kids' drag event until a later date. They haven't said when or where that might actually occur. But it's certainly something that got a whole lot of social media buzz. And it's really not all that surprising given just how much attention has been given to, things like Drag Queen Story Hour over the past couple years here in Idaho and across the country. Not to mention, the sort of nod to the QAnon conspiracy theory about, satanic pedophilic sex cults that are run by Democrats and the Hollywood elite, calling people groomers, for example, if they, support these sorts of drag shows or, certain books in libraries, for example. So it's not all that surprising, but it's been an eventful couple days.
Yeah, to say the least. And Melissa, how is the Department of Health and Welfare involved in all of this?
Initially, the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare and Central District Health were both sponsors. IDHW had been planning to have a booth about HIV and STD prevention. Project Filter was going to have a booth there, which, of course, is aimed at helping provide resources for people to quit smoking. Yesterday, they pulled their sponsorship and their participation in the Boise Pride Festival. Director Dave Jepson wrote a letter outlining his concerns, basically, with the inclusion of events that were for minors. CDH, Central District Health, is still going to be putting on a monkeypox clinic. Monkeypox, of course, the vast majority of people who have tested positive in this country are men who have sex with men. And so from the beginning, public health districts have been really targeting, especially at-risk communities. Those three monkeypox clinics are still going on. I just checked the monkeypox landing page through Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. They still list the information on there. So it doesn't appear like they're completely distancing themselves when it comes to that public health aspect. Central District Health is the one that is putting on those monkeypox clinics, according to Idaho Capital Sun. So that taxpayer-funded component had always been focused on that public health interface with Pride, but only the monkeypox clinic is going to continue, how it seems.
Okay, and also I think it's worth noting that when all of this happened, Jimmy, the Idaho Republican Party, I guess for lack of a better word, put out a call to action to Pride sponsors regarding their sponsorship. And basically saying, you know, you need to call, you need to be polite, but tell them that, you know, they need to remove their sponsorship, or if not, take your business elsewhere. Jimmy, A, have we seen something like this before from the Republican Party? I mean, this drastic. But also, I'm curious about, you know, what this then means for the future of Pride events, you know, in the Treasure Valley.
Yeah, nothing's really coming to mind of something that was like this sustained and seemingly well organized, you know, among the Idaho Republican uh-huh. Party and, you know, actual other far right groups too on Facebook that were, you know, sharing all of those phone numbers and email addresses for, you know, several sponsors, you know, to mount this pressure campaign. As for further Pride events, I mean, something that I noticed is that a lot of these statements from the sponsors just said that they were withdrawing their participation. It's not clear whether or not they have actually pulled their money out. So, you know, are they, you know, sponsoring this and supporting Pride behind the scenes and they just want to lower the temperature? That's a question that still needs to be answered publicly. But certainly it could potentially spell, you know, future controversies for, you know, mm-hmm. next year's Pride. Obviously, mm-hmm. in Coeur d'Alene a few months ago, we saw the arrest of, you know, more than 30 white supremacists, who were, you know, allegedly going to go riot at that, at Coeur d'Alene's, Pride event. So it's also nothing new. I mean, Pride has been around for decades and has faced tons and tons of protests, but, you know, this seems to be some sort of renewed, you know, a backlash against that.
I want to switch gears now. And Nate, I want to bring you into the conversation because EastIdahoNews.com is basically leading the charge to try to get cameras in the courtroom for the Velo Daybell trials. And Nate, this is because my understanding is that the defense attorneys for Lori Velo Daybell asked that cameras not be allowed in the courtroom.
Yeah. Essentially, late last month, they filed a claim, the defense attorneys filed a claim that said that the media had abused their privilege to photograph and video court proceedings. This was during a middle of August hearing, and Court TV had brought a whole setup into the courthouse to film a hearing. And the defense attorneys are claiming that the cameras were placed in a way that we could zoom in a sensational way on the defendant, who was Lori. They also mm-hmm. suggested that mics were put in a way that could have been used to record confidential conversations, and that cameras could also have been used to zoom in on confidential notes on the desk of the defense attorneys. Now, none of that actually happened. There were no confidential conversations recorded, and there was no zooming in on confidential notes. In fact, the media followed to the letter everything the judge outlined in his court order allowing cameras into the courtroom. So this got us a little riled up. Because obviously we want to be able to show this case. It has a huge national attention. And so we went out and we hired an attorney to intervene in the case and file a response. We reached out to other media, and we got a huge response. We got 32 partners, local media, a ton of state media, and we even got a bunch of national media, NBC, ABC, CBS, and CNN all joined in the case and essentially are saying that the media has done nothing wrong. We've acted professional throughout this entire ordeal. And that it's really necessary that cameras stay in the courtroom. That's an essential part of journalism.
Mm-hmm. And so you're waiting now for the judge to make their decision on this, correct?
Well, what's going to happen is on September 15th, there's going to be a hearing, and the defense attorneys are going to argue their motion to get cameras banned, and our attorney will also argue to keep them in there.
Okay. And so once that happens, so September 15th, next week, then you will see if the judge makes a decision at that point.
Yes. And it's worth noting that for that hearing, the judge is allowing cameras and is allowing live streaming.
Okay. Good to know. All right, Margaret, I want to talk about something that, very differing views on this. And this is alcohol, in particular, Idaho's liquor licensing laws, to be exact. Some folks have been calling for reform. Other folks are like, hey, leave it alone. Explain why there is such a debate around this. And then what could be happening, I think, this legislative session.
So liquor licenses in Idaho are not what you might think they are. In many other states, if you want to have a liquor license, you can just sign up, get one in your restaurant, and you are all good. In Idaho, we have a quota system where there are only a set amount of licenses that are available for each community, each city, based on population for every 1,500 folks. So that's why if you go to a tiny Idaho town on a vacation, there's only going to be two bars. You're going to have two choices if you want to have a cocktail. And so this has obviously created some consternation because restaurant owners who want to have a liquor license, or they want to open a bar, or they build a new hotel and they want to put a bar in their hotel, are frustrated that they cannot just get a liquor license. They feel locked out. And then they go to the secondary market and say, okay, what's available here? Can I buy one from someone who has them? And they will either not be for sale or will run hundreds of thousands of dollars. Liquor licenses are running an average of, I think it was $350,000 in Boise.
Wow.
That's buying a house, and not even like that's buying a house that isn't even super, super cheap. And so it's a really complicated, tough system. But then on the other side, there's these business owners who've invested. They have a business. They have a liquor license. They paid the $350,000 and all that money. And they're saying, you can't just open up the market because then that's going to diminish the value of what I paid in my investment. And it will also hurt businesses because oftentimes the value of that liquor license enhances the value of the business. So then if I owned a bar for 50 million years and then I decided to retire and I had a liquor license, I could then sell my business for quite a lot of money purely because there's a liquor license attached to it and everybody wants a liquor license. But then if they're not that valuable anymore, then there goes my retirement. There goes my plans for the future, maybe inheritance for my children, all those sorts of things. In this hypothetical universe where I own a bar and am very old and I'm not on this show. It's tough. And this session, we're probably going to see potentially some new conversation about if there should be reform. There's usually sometimes talk about, hey, we should open up this system, create more liquor license availability. Businesses like Space Bar here in Boise who are trying to find a liquor license, they're really going to want that. There's also another proposal from the group Fair Idaho, which you might have heard of. They promote independent restaurants and beverage producers in Idaho. And they're proposing an interesting idea, which they're calling a historic license bill. And on that proposal, if you have a business that has been having a liquor license and operating with the same LLC, the same entity for, I think it was 25 years, you get a permanent historic license that you cannot sell and not transfer to anybody. And then that business could then turn around and take that other license that they had and sell it. So it adds that extra, basically a net gain. And I think the estimate was a little over a dozen new licenses would be created in Boise and several other, you know, and others around the state if that bill was enacted. And their idea, and Fair Idaho's idea behind this is that it would add more supply to the market. Okay, so then all those people who are sitting there clamoring for a license will be able to have one to buy. And then, you know, the age old adage of supply and demand will bring prices down and they won't be nearly as valuable because there will be simply be more of them. This bill would not limit a restaurant owner who gets that second license to sell it to anyone they want. They could sell it to an Olive Garden that's willing to pay $500,000 or a real estate investor, as opposed to like someone who a mom and pop person is trying to open a restaurant. So they could still sell it to people that maybe have deep pockets and are willing to pay high dollar. So it'd be interesting to see if this comes to the state house, what people have to say about it. And then if it passes, what the actual impact would be. And I think it's going to be interesting to see exactly how this new crop of legislators is going to react to this concept.
Yeah, absolutely. Jimmy, update us on Republican lawmakers who have asked a federal judge to reconsider his injunction around an abortion bill here in Idaho.
Yeah, so this motion was filed late Wednesday night, I believe, if time means anything to me after this week. So the injunction was, you know, issued late last month by federal judge Lynn Windmill, basically carving out this narrow exception in Idaho's near total abortion ban to allow for emergency abortions in cases where a pregnancy threatens the health of the mother. Idaho's law allows for something or for an abortion if a pregnancy threatens the life of the mother, but not necessarily the health of the mother, which during that hearing, the state admitted that an ectopic pregnancy, which, you know, essentially can lead to a ruptured ovary or fallopian tube, I mean, and cause severe bleeding and even death, would be, you know, you couldn't get an abortion under the way that Idaho's law is written for that condition. So anyway, Lynn Windmill decided to issue this ruling saying that no, those sorts of abortions would be allowed because it conflicts with a federal law requiring hospitals that get Medicare dollars to treat emergency conditions. And in their motion to reconsider that, Idaho lawmakers are essentially saying that, you know, the Biden administration was trying to score political points with its, you know, lawsuit bringing this lawsuit forward back in July. And that they also purposefully left out of, you know, all of their briefing materials and in their arguments, part of this definition under that federal law that does include the health of an unborn child when, you know, there's a pregnant mother in the situation. Mm-hmm. So they're essentially saying that, you know, they totally, you know, overlooked this part of it. And the federal judge, you know, didn't bother to look at the statute when he issued his injunction, and they want this to, you know, be reversed partially and only allow abortions in cases that do conflict in their mind with this federal law, which isn't exactly clear what they mean by that, since, you know, they said that they don't see any conflict with ectopic pregnancies, for example. During that hearing, I think the lawyer said something to the effect of, you know, Idaho does a lot of things, but it's not stupid enough to produce a prosecutor that would, you know, charge a doctor for aborting an ectopic pregnancy, even though the state said that, yeah, no, that would not qualify under our current law.
All right. So we'll have to wait and see on that one. Margaret, what is the latest with the city of Boise and the Boise Fire Union? They can't seem to be coming to a deal.
Right. These talks on the city's union contract have been going on all summer. And my publisher, Don Day, has been reporting on this pretty extensively. And this week, he reported on a final round of negotiations. And the city and the fire union are pretty far apart. And so they're going to be going to an arbitration process and having to figure this out where they're going to mediate. And so just to tell you where they are, so the city is proposing a two-year contract with a 5.9% raise in the first year and a 5% raise in the second year. And they recently gave out a similar 5.9 raise to all of the city's non-union employees. The union is looking for a 3 to 4 year contract. And in a 3 year contract, they're looking for a 10% raise in the first year, a 10% raise in the second year, and then 3% in that third year. And so that would, you know, math is hard. I can't come up with this right now. But, you know, that's a lot. I mean, that is quite a hike for those sorts of employees. And it's definitely much higher than what the city is proposing and what the city has proposed to their other employees. And during the meeting, City Chief of Staff Courtney Washburn basically said, "Hey, we're having problems with coming to an agreement and seeing where you guys are on this by looking at economic data and surrounding pay for other fire departments in the area. So we'll see what happens with this. But if the union ends up coming out on the winning side of this negotiation, or even if they're somewhere in the middle, that is a not insignificant hit to, or not hit, that is a not insignificant amount that the city budget would have to absorb. And then the city is going to have to make decisions about, okay, are we going to cut other programs and really focus on the fire department and their pay and their contract? Are we going to hike taxes? This is not a small price tag negotiation.
So, Melissa, quite a bit happened in this special session last week. Can you first talk about Reclaim Idaho and what they're pulling their initiative off the November ballot?
Yes, our friends at the Idaho Capital Sun talked to Luke Mayville, who is the head of Reclaim Idaho, about their decision. And, you know, he told them at the time they took a really, really close look at this. They had a lot of difficult conversations with supporters around the state. And after the special session and House Bill 1 passed, he told them it became clear that it was unlikely that Proposition 1, the Quality Education Act, would receive the majority needed to become law. Now, remember, House Bill 1 was written so that it would essentially replace the Quality Education Act should that have passed. Like so many laws and so many voter initiatives, it would have taken effect January 1st. House Bill 1 is going to take effect on January 3rd. And so it, you know, would have the effect, remember, of the Quality Education Act would have added a new tax bracket for high income earners specifically to generate education funding. The law that comes into effect on January 3rd will create a flat tax. And so it would have made that top tier income bracket disappear. So that is one of the many, many effects that we're seeing after the special session last week.
Mm-hmm. And then the other issue with the special session, Melissa, had to do with some sales tax changes.
Right. The House Bill 1, one of the other parts of that is it generates more than $400 million for public education, including a newly created in-demand careers fund, which will receive $80 million, and K-12, which will get about $330 million. That comes from sales tax revenue. Now, education isn't going to be the only recipient of those sales tax funds. Right now, local governments and cities, or including cities, get about 11% of sales tax. Now, that's down from what they used to get, which was 13.75%. That percentage reduced in 2006 after that special session, which increased the sales tax from 5% to 6%. And so since then, local governments have really been trying to convince the state legislature to increase the share of money that they get so that they don't have to raise local property taxes so much to fund a lot of their, the local improvements that they make. That make so many Idaho communities a great place to live. Kelly Packer, the executive director of the Association of Idaho Cities, told me on Tuesday that they had asked the governor to reconsider his proposal when that draft piece of legislation came out before the special session, saying that, you know, local governments have so many needs. And, you know, she cited one town in Idaho that is considering, you know, having to go back to gravel roads because they just don't have enough money for some of these improvements. She said she didn't really hear back from the governor's office other than a thank you. And she's really turning her efforts now to trying to convince the upcoming legislature and all these new lawmakers that they really need to take a look at property taxes and figuring out a way to make it so that these locals keep getting the revenue that they need for their improvements while making it a little bit less painful for people who are paying those taxes every year.
Nate, I have about 2 minutes left in the show and I want to wrap up with you because all you have to do is look outside and see all of the smoke in the air. But what people may not realize is that we have the largest wildfire in the country burning in Idaho right now near Salmon. What is the latest and how are firefighters dealing with all of this?
You know, they're having a really hard time getting hold of this fire. It's now 122,000 acres. It's been going since July 17th, and it's not estimated to be fully contained till October 31st.
Wow.
They've gotten hundreds of firefighters working on it. And at the moment, it's only 35% contained. And every time they seem to make some progress with it, where containment goes up a little bit, a couple days later, it goes right back down. It's in a really hazardous, difficult to reach area up near Salmon. And it's causing a lot of problems. It's going to be there for a while.
Right. Which then means firefighters will have to stay on the lines. You said at least until the end of October.
Yes.
Could that change? I mean, could they get it contained sooner? I mean, I guess you could, but that is a long time.
It is. And when we talk to the people up there, they're not optimistic. They think it's going to last right up until probably even November.
Okay. I want to thank all of you for joining us today, for all of the reporting that you do. Really appreciate you all so much. We've been talking with Melissa Davlin. She's the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com. Nate Sunderland, managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com. And our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a good Friday and a good weekend.
Thanks, Gemma. You too.
I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters.